Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
I think the Democrats are used to this from a Republican Party that hasn't had a backbone. Yes. You're not going to see that this time around.
So you're hearing this morning from Donald Trump Jr. saying that there are going to be lawsuits over voter fraud. The big thing he's looking at are votes showing up late in certain states. And he says it's because Democrats are controlling the courts to blame. So Congressman Jim Himes, I'm sure you've heard all about this. I'm sure you're keeping a very close eye on all of the claims coming from the Trump administration. What is your reaction to everything going on with potential voter fraud? What's your reaction to that?
Well, Melissa, my reaction is pretty obvious, which is that there is not a shred of evidence that there is any voter fraud out there. And of course, if there were, Donald Trump Jr. and Donald Trump Sr. would be trumpeting it. What is happening right now is exactly what we knew would happen. All over the country, including here in Connecticut, provision was made for people to vote by mail and in some states to postmark that ballot by Election Day. And consequently, it's likely to resolve today, but it's taken a couple of days to get the results. And of course, you know, because President Trump urged his supporters not to vote by mail, the mail-in votes are coming in, not surprisingly, skewed in favor of Joe Biden. So, look, what's important now, Melissa, is that every legal vote be counted. And that is what is happening in states that are not necessarily Democratic states. Nobody thinks of Georgia or Arizona, which we've been talking about for 3 days now, mm-hmm. as particularly Democratic states. The notion that the Democrats control the courts is beyond absurd. The president just spent 4 years, of course, filling the federal courts with his nominees. So the important thing is that, you know, the core idea of our democracy is that each individual's vote matters. If there is voter fraud, which so far we have not seen one shred of evidence that there is, mm-hmm. That should be disallowed. Mm-hmm. And anybody who commits voter fraud should be charged with the felony that it is. But again, if somebody's alleging voter fraud, they can't just say that it's happening. They need to say where and when and how so that it can be investigated. And of course, that part hasn't happened.
Do you believe, Congressman Himes, if, you know, things were tipping in the other direction where, you know, right now, numbers don't lie. Joe Biden is really within reach of becoming the president elect because he's got more of the electoral votes, excuse me. But do you think if things were in the opposite direction, do you believe, you know, that Biden and his team would do kind of the same thing that Trump's administration is doing, which is to file lawsuits over voter fraud?
No, I don't. Well, let me say this. If there was evidence of voter fraud, yes, they would. But absent any evidence of voter fraud, and again, I've been watching this pretty closely. I haven't seen any evidence. If somebody has, and it's not just a figment of Donald Trump Jr.'s imagination, if a court has actually found that, remember the courts have been all over this and nobody has actually found it, that should be dealt with. But, you know, Melissa, the answer to your question is actually historically clear. In the 2000 election, which was hard fought, and it was many, many weeks before we knew the outcome, Al Gore stood in front of the country and gave that very famous speech in which he said, the court's decision must prevail here. Donald Trump is taking the opposite tack. He is lying to the American people, as he did last night. The strategy is an interesting one. He's trying to, and his people are trying to demand that votes be counted in states, you know, that he seems to be picking up votes, but he's demanding that the vote be stopped in states like Pennsylvania, where his lead is declining. So it's pretty obvious what is happening here. But to your question, remember how Al Gore behaved in 2000 when he addressed the country and said that this is over. I don't remember Hillary Clinton in 2016, even though it was an enormously close election, saying anything about corruption or voter fraud or litigating. So the answer to your question is yes. If the shoe were on the other foot, the presidential candidate of the Democratic Party would not act anything like the president is acting.
Talking to Congressman Jim Himes this morning, and Congressman Himes, something that I also was just kind of thinking about with – you know, we are going into now a third day after election of not knowing who is going to run the country. You know, one of the things that we were waiting on was that once we had an election in the books, was that we were going to see a relief package possibly for the American people. Do we have any idea when that will even happen at this point, especially if there are lawsuits that are probably going to follow no matter which way you look at it? I do think that either side would do lawsuits. And I'm just curious, you know, if this continues to play out for weeks, I mean, are we looking at not seeing a relief package even discussed now for months?
Well, look, I actually think the politics will be resolved pretty soon. Joe Biden is up by more than 4 million votes in the popular vote. Now, as we both know, that's not what determines the presidency,
right?
But the popular mandate here is very clear. Currently, he's leading in Georgia and Nevada. If that lead holds, which is those leads are actually expanding, that's it. That's game over. He's likely to win Pennsylvania. This is likely to be a big Electoral College win. And the litigation that the Trump folks are undertaking is being dismissed very, very rapidly because there's just not a basis for that litigation. So my guess is that the presidency is going to be resolved fairly quickly. Now, Donald Trump may not accept that, but, you know, he's not going to find a court that imagines voter fraud or something. But to your question about the stimulus package, which is really, I think, an important question, you know, there was a deal, and gosh, we spent weeks talking about this. There was a deal pretty close between Speaker Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. And I think that deal can be brought off the shelf, you know, tomorrow. The question is, of course, because nobody's very good at predicting Donald Trump's behavior, whether you like him or don't, nobody's very good at predicting his behavior. If he does lose this election, which looks likely, how does he respond? What happens in a lame duck? Does that make him more likely to do a deal or less likely? That's really the question that I can't answer for you. But one thing that I can answer for you is that deal is more important than ever. You know, it's nice to see people moving into our communities and property values going up, but we're also seeing an uptick in the disease, and we are still living under a great deal of economic pain. So that stimulus package needs to be job one, hopefully in days, not weeks.
Congressman Himes, thanks for coming on this morning, and we'll talk again next week.
Thank you, Melissa.
I know a lot of you have been so focused on the election for very good reason, but COVID is still very much a part of our daily lives, whether we like it or not. And this was actually a question over the summertime. Many teachers came forward and said, listen, if we don't feel comfortable returning to a classroom, will our employers basically get rid of us? Are we going to be punished? Are we not going to have our contracts renewed? Those were a lot of questions that local teachers had. And I'm hearing this morning the first lawsuit in Connecticut that's in the COVID era challenging the no remote teaching policy that Norwalk and other schools have adopted during the pandemic. That's underway right now. And in fact, the attorney representing this teacher is Gary Phelan, who is here this morning to talk to us a little bit on behalf of this Norwalk teacher who has asthma, it sounds like. Gary, first of all, thank you for coming on to talk about this. How are you?
Great. Thank you for inviting me.
So first and foremost, Gary, obviously we're not giving out identities, which is perfectly fine. But I think this is a pretty trying lawsuit. I think this is something that many teachers will be wanting to understand a little bit better. Certainly employers will want to understand it better. So can you give us background on what this case looks like? You don't have to give names, but just background.
Okay, well, it's just where, you know, my client had sought to be permitted to teach remotely because she has a medical condition which makes her high risk if she were to contract COVID, which is true of many people with a variety of conditions, everything from heart disease, cancer, diabetes. And so working remotely has certainly been the most common type of accommodation mm-hmm. for people who are high risk. Many school districts adopted the principle of just no remote teaching. And as a result, teachers have been left with, in many school districts, with the option of, do I go without an income, you know, for the next year? Or do I, you know, take the huge risk and go in? And that's really what we're challenging.
So, Gary, I'm going to just go back for 1 second, because to be honest with you, I've been following COVID very closely. Obviously, it's been literally the center of my show since March, even before that. I was not aware, though, that there are actually cities or towns, districts in Connecticut that have policies in place where they're not allowing any remote teaching. They're not allowing that. I guess I don't understand. I didn't realize that that was actually in existence.
Yes, not just in Connecticut, around the country. And it was often in August when the school districts announced the policy to bring everybody back to be in the classroom. So
even if kids are at home, they still have to be in the classroom.
Correct.
Okay. And that's Norwalk. Yeah, Norwalk has that policy.
Norwalk and several others. Again, several other school districts, that's not the case.
Okay. So my question then is, so they put this policy in place before the school year. Why now is it coming up? Like, why has this lawsuit come up now?
Well, to try to to challenge the policy. We've tried to reach some sort of resolution to the heart of reasonable accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act, is to try to, work out a compromise. That did not happen in this case. So the only option left is to pursue legal action.
Mm-hmm. Talking this morning to Gary Fallon, who is an attorney representing a Norwalk teacher who has asthma, is my understanding, Gary. And this is one of the first lawsuits in the state during COVID that challenges the no remote teaching policy that both Norwalk and many other school districts have apparently adopted before the school year. And Gary, my question is for your client. So she wants to work from home for understandable reasons, because she has an underlying condition that could exacerbate, if she gets COVID, her being able to overcome it and fight it off, which we've heard many times from the governor. We've heard it from our state health department. We've heard it from Dr. Fauci. So what is her employer saying? So if she doesn't want to show up to school because she's nervous about getting COVID, and we are seeing, look, Norwalk was one of the first schools, if not the first, during the summertime, that they had to send their kids home a day after they opened up for summer school because of COVID cases. So has she been not employed this whole time?
You're right. She's currently on FMLA leave.
Okay.
And so until she was approved, her FMLA leave was approved, she was continuing to submit lesson plans and to have somebody, a teacher's aide who was, sort of implementing the plans.
Okay.
Often what happens in school districts is they have paraprofessionals, teacher's aides who are helping teachers anyway. And so, you basically use, the teachers teaching remotely, as is happening in a lot of school districts and colleges and universities around the country, but often with, for example, younger students, you may have somebody in the classroom facilitating.
Yeah, no, I mean, I totally understand what you're saying. I'm very surprised by this, like, especially, even this morning we were breaking down phase 2.1 and the governor saying, look, if you can work remotely, I want you working remotely. And in Norwalk right now, ironically enough, as we're talking about this, is one of the highest infected rated areas of Connecticut. So I think it's interesting. I know it's not really coming from the schools per se, but I think it's interesting that any school district would adopt this policy. Like, I get that there are shortages of teachers, but to me, we already lack really good educators. So I don't know why we wouldn't find like a middle ground here. I'm very surprised by this. So what does your client want to get out of this?
Ideally, that she be, that they make the accommodation. Allow her to teach, remotely, that we work on an accommodation. Also, another problem has been, because of this policy that many school districts has adopted, there's been many good teachers who've retired or who have left teaching because they chose not to risk their lives in going back in. And I'm talking about teachers who, not just a question of that they were uncomfortable. Many people are uncomfortable. It's that they have a medical condition that places them at much higher risk than most people.
Okay. Well, Gary Phelan, we would love to get an update on this lawsuit as it continues to play out. I'm sure it will have a rippling effect on many other school teachers across our area. So I thank you for coming on, explaining all this to us this morning, and we'd love to get in touch with you again soon.
Okay. Thank you.
So we are just days away from Veterans Day next week, and I wanted to talk about how we take care of our veterans here in Connecticut. So joining me this morning is Vince Fantilli, who's with Homes for the Brave. And Vince, thanks for coming on this morning. I appreciate it. How are you?
Oh, my goodness, Melissa. Greetings from Homes for the Brave. And thanks so much to you and WICC for having us on this morning.
Oh, absolutely. You never have to thank us. I love what Homes for the Brave does. In fact, fun fact, back in 2015, I was nominated for a New York Emmy doing a story on you guys. So I have a very strong connection with you. When I worked at News 12, I did a lot of stories with you guys, and I love the work that you do. So thank you for all that you do for our veterans.
Well, thank you. And you know what? I just got here in 2016, so I must have just missed you.
That's okay. No worries. At least we're together now. And I wanted to talk about something that I highlighted in that piece years ago, which is that Homes for the Brave recognizes, first of all, that veterans need help when they come back home. I think that they go through trauma that unless you go through it yourself, you have absolutely no idea what they go through mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. And when they come home, it almost is as bad, if not worse, for them because they return home to something that is so unrecognizable and they feel like nobody understands them. And on top of it, a lot of times they don't have a home, they don't have employment. So let's start by talking about what you find at Homes for the Brave for our veterans.
Well, Melissa, transitioning back into the civilian world can be a difficult thing. And we find that our male and female veterans, by the way, we have the first and only home in the state of Connecticut exclusively for female veterans and their young children. We have a young lady with a 5-year-old little boy there right now, and which we are so proud to provide that service. And, you know, we have men and women in their 20s, in their 80s, and everything in between. So sometimes the difficulties don't arise the moment they take the uniform off, but could take place months, years, even decades later. And so what we, our whole mission revolves around getting our men and women back to the point at which they can become permanently housed. And that could include getting their own apartment, moving back in with a significant other, moving back in with a parent or child. And in order to do that, they have to secure an income, which can be from employment or can be from, you know, finding about benefits that they didn't even know they were eligible for.
Vince, how difficult, or I would say what challenges would you say veterans are facing in Connecticut in general? Like, where are we lacking? I have to imagine Connecticut, there's a lot, obviously, on our local and our state leaders, you know, on their plates. But veterans, do you believe, honestly, in your heart, do you believe veterans are enough of a priority in Connecticut, or are we still coming up short?
Well, I think we are making them a priority, Melissa, but here's the number one difficulty, and that's securing affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Even here in the city of Bridgeport, if you ever saw what some of the rents are that our men and women are then faced with having to pay every single month.
Oh, it's insane.
That is job number one for us, is helping them find something that they can afford. And we are even doing a lot of strategic planning now, and we're looking into the possibility of us expanding into providing more permanent housing alternatives.
Wow, that's amazing. Talking this morning to Vince Fantilli, who's with Homes for the Brave, and, you know, just ahead of Veterans Day, wanted to really talk about where veterans are at when they return home to Connecticut. So let's talk about this program that Homes for the Brave has. How does it work? What I think is interesting is they're kind of interconnected, right? When I did this story years back, we actually followed two veterans, one who was actually working to fix up an apartment for another veteran who needed a home. And I thought it was just this very neat process for veterans.
Well, when you say where they're at, I mean, they come to us. Many of the men and women that we, especially on the male side, are coming to us battling addictions. Some of them are coming to us with mental health challenges. PTSD is a very, very common denominator at both our male and our female houses. And what we try to do is then in a relatively short time. I mean, typically it's, you know, they have it's 90 days to 2 years, but the average stay here in our men's house in the year that ended June 30th was 109 days. The average stay in our female house was 143 days last year.
Wow.
So when you think we take a male or female veteran and they're coming in struggling and homeless and possibly even sleeping in their car, maybe even having a child with them doing so, and we then get them prepared to become permanently housed in 109 and 143 days, that is positively magical.
No, it absolutely is. Now, Vince, what about, I've got to imagine COVID kind of impacted things, or, you know, the other side of things is, how much capacity do you guys still have available for veterans?
Well, right now, because of COVID, we have to retain certain rooms as isolation rooms. When male or female veterans are coming in, we have to then initially isolate them and so on and so forth. Roughly 20% of our men are coming from Department of Corrections, which often is, you know, a very challenging place as far as really inhibiting the spread of COVID. So we've had our hands full, Melissa, for 8 months. And, you know, our male house here on Park Avenue, the capacity is 42 beds, but certainly we have to hold it well below that right now. And, you know, and certainly at the female house, it's a 14-bed home, but we're nowhere near that capacity at the moment because we're unable to just certain rooms we have to hold aside. And, you know, we've tried to accelerate the housing search when the pandemic first started. And everything we do here, we've had to do differently.
Mm-hmm.
We would have weekly house, you know, like a house meeting for the entire, you know, resident, for all the residents. And, you know, we had to then do that in shifts.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have one, you know, they'd all sit and have dinner at the same time. We then have to do that in multiple sittings. We have to do everything differently. We would have groups come and cook and serve meals here during the weekdays, on weekday evenings, on weekends. Obviously, we've had a curtail. March 10th, the gate kind of closed where that's concerned. So our expenses as it pertains to food, we've had our caterer here then 7 days a week at both houses. And, you know, PPE, cleaning supplies, everything has become more expensive for us, and we've just had to really focus our efforts on keeping our men and women safe and healthy.
Well, we thank you for the efforts.
And our staff, for that matter, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's very true, Vince. Well, thank you so much, Vince, for giving us a highlight and a look into what Homes for the Brave does in Bridgeport. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you, Melissa.
We'll talk again really soon. I forgot what you're making this morning. I'm so sorry. Oh,
that's
man.
Okay, honey. Listen, I get it.
I know you get it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I sent you a picture of it. We're doing the baked apples.
That's it. Yes, Nicholas's famous bit. Well, they're your baked apples, but Nicholas used to eat these like by the pounds when we were kids. My God.
I can't make enough of them.
That's amazing. So, yeah, how do you make baked apples? This is not the same as apple crisp.
No, this is just, you know, I know everybody thinks like, oh my gosh, winter's here, but it's not. We're still like in the middle of fall. So, and apples like are just perfect right now. You can get any kind of apple. They're in abundance. It's great. So what I do, and you could do it either way, you could put all your ingredients in a bowl, mix them together. But I don't do that. So,
Oh, they know by now. I think all of our listeners know by now that you don't just, you know, do it half done.
Right.
So, yeah. So how do you start?
What I do is you need to core your apple. And I do not have a corer, an apple corer, although I might go get one. But anyway, what I do is I peel around the stem area about, I don't know, maybe a half an inch so that you see the apple without the skin. And then, you know, I cut out the core. You could do it with like a metal spoon but you don't want to cut, you don't want to go through the whole core. You definitely need a bottom. Then
okay.
I just line them up. Now, for those of you we need like a recipe. You could put them all this stuff in a bowl, mix it, and then put it in the middle. But I just take each ingredient and go over each apple, and that's with brown sugar, cinnamon, and like with the cinnamon, I just sprinkle it all over, like the little white part on the top, and so you see me sprinkling, and a little in the middle.
You're such a good sprinkler.
Yeah, the brown sugar, you could, you know, I just sprinkle it around the outside and put some in the middle. I do not do mine with nuts, although I may try next time with nuts. This first one I just did with the raisins and the butter. You put like a tab of butter in the center of each one, and then as many raisins as you like. And I like to go heavy on the raisins. So it's really, you know, brown sugar, cinnamon, raisins, and butter. And, you know, you can put in any other kind of, you know, like cranberries. You could put those in. And you can also use any kind of nut you like. And then when your apples are all stuffed and they're lined up, you need to put somewhere around 3/4 of a cup of water on the bottom. Now, depending on how many apples you do, you may need more than 3/4 of a cup. So I do a ton of apples. I do probably like 10. And so I get a big pan. So I make sure it's like a half an inch. The apples are sitting at least in a half an inch of water.
Okay.
And then I just put them in the oven at like 350, 375. And I cook them. I mean, you could cook them about a half an hour, and then I check them. You don't want them mushy, but you want to make sure, like, you kind of could stick a knife in the white part and see that it comes out nice, because you don't want them undercooked, but you don't want them mushy.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a nice balance, if you will.
It's a great balance, an easy dessert, and everybody loves them, and the house smells amazing.
It does. That's true. Now, do you ever add, like, vanilla ice cream, or do you ever add, like, any whipped cream to these, or are they good on their own?
I mean, of course. Like, put a scoop of vanilla ice cream next to it. It's like eating apple pie with vanilla ice cream. Whipped cream, I would just take that from the center and all around the apple, and... Absolutely, you should use those. I don't seem to need them. People just go after the apple, but, you know, Grandma downstairs.
She loves her ice cream.
For vanilla ice cream.
Well, I mean, I find that in your kitchen, Mom, it's like as soon as something's done, you can't even get it on the table before it's all gone. So that's probably why I've never had it with ice cream, because it's usually gone before we even get it to the table. So. There you go.
Well, I know.
Yeah.
But I'm going to make another batch of them Sunday, and I will pick up vanilla ice cream or whipped cream.
All right. Sounds good, Mom. Well, that sounds delicious. And I will throw it up onto the podcast after the show. Thanks, Mom.